Welcome to Paddling Adventures Radio. I'm Sean Rowley, and with me is Derek Spech.
Hello.
Derek.
Good day, sir.
How's it going?
It's going fantastic.
Good week?
They're busy all week? Good weeks. Well, they're all busy. They're all busy. They're all good.
Busy, busy, busy.
Mm-hmm. The kids have... This is the kids' last week from school.
When oh, summer.
When is this?
Yeah, this is next week, because yeah. I'm away right now.
Then the kids are back in school.
How are the kids enjoying their first day back at school? How are you enjoying their first week and back at school?
So the thing is all summer, it's like, okay, guys, you don't want to waste your summer. You only get so many of them, and then you're out in the workforce, yada, yada, yada. Enjoy your summers. And I probably talk to them every week about this. You got to do stuff. You got to do stuff. I don't care if you go hang out with your friends. You got to do stuff. Anyways, they're back to school.
You had your chance. You mm-hmm. wasted it.
Yeah, they did.
Oh, well. Nothing you can do.
Beckett played Minecraft all summer, and Stella reads books, so I guess that's not a loss.
At least somebody in the house does.
Hey, I told you I read some books over my vacation. I yeah. devoured a bunch of them.
Rip devoured. This page out to start a fire. Rip this page out to start the fire. yeah, it's been busy, busy, busy. So just, we are recording this week because I'm away in Temagami for 10 days starting mm-hmm. Saturday. So this will actually air while I'm up there.
Yep. But if you set it up properly.
If I set it up properly. Yeah. if you're not listening to this,
it might be late because Sean did it.
Yeah, I messed something up because I was just too much in a hurry to pack. And
yeah.
I think it started. I made beef jerky and that's it. That's as close. I've got Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. I got 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
Plus I work. So yeah. I got 3 evenings to get ready for a 10-day canoe trip.
Getting kind of tight.
And you know what I've done?
Nah.
I've made jerky. That is it.
That's not a lot.
Oh, man. Uh-oh. Just so busy. I had a trip back in May, a long weekend back in May. And that's it.
Oh, yeah.
That's all I've done. That's all I've had the time for. I've not had this little paddling in a season.
Well.
But you know what? I did the whole
12 months paddle, of paddling.
12 months of paddling, and this is the payback.
Yeah. Nothing.
Oh, you used all your paddling time up during the winter, didn't you, fool? This is my payback.
Yeah.
No, you know what? I haven't had a summer this busy with other stuff in ages. So it's nice to be heading out on a nice 10-day trip. So anyway, we got some things to talk about.
Yes, we do.
There's something else I was going to mention. I didn't write it down, and I should have, because now I can't remember what it was.
I sent you quite a few things over the last couple of days.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of jokes. That's what the internet is for.
Yeah.
It's nothing serious.
Yeah.
Guy that invented the internet, if he only knew.
I know. I can't believe this fantastic thing I created is only used for porn and jokes.
Right? And jokey porn.
Yes.
There's a new documentary from the Nature of Things called Jossum, Canada's Great White Sharks.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And it explores the history of great white sharks in the Atlantic and whether they've become more common there. Do you remember a few years ago, Alan Drummond was out in Nova Scotia.
And he was on the watch for the shark. Did he see it? He didn't see it,
but it was the big news.
Everybody was messaging him, hey, while you're there.
Yeah, look for the great whites. And, I mean, that was a new thing. And now they're just being seen a lot more. White sharks seen on the East Coast are part of a population that stretches from South America all the way to Newfoundland. They visit Canada seasonally in the late summer and early fall. You can see them a lot more than before, says Michael Bask, a fisherman from Potlatek First Nation, roughly 250 kilometers northeast of Halifax. He says up until about 10 years ago, it was rare to see a shark. Yeah, like you never heard about it. Atlantic great white sharks are considered endangered in Canada.
Yeah, well, they're not endangered, but they're endangered in Canada.
Mm-hmm. And they are listed as a vulnerable species around the world. As a population, they're difficult to study and monitor because they are mostly solitary and can migrate thousands of kilometers. There's a lot of animals in the animal world that do these massive migrations.
Yeah.
And you're just like, wow. You know, like the whales even going up and down the coast and across.
And when they track them, it's really interesting to see how far they get. Now, this one here, is this species of great white, is that a very unique species?
No.
They call it Atlantic great white sharks. They're just sharks that have found their waves up north, right?
Yeah, they're just in the Atlantic Ocean as opposed to the Pacific. But there was that not a fox they put a tag on and it went across the ice somewhere over and found it into Russia?
Oh, I don't know.
It was like crossing continents sort of thing. Like this one, I'm sure it was a fox. I'll have to Google that again.
Yeah.
That was a few years back, but he says, unlike dolphins and whales, which come up to his boat to show off, sharks are a lot less curious. Sharks, you get a glimpse of them, and they're usually gone. And that's what's spooky about it. If you're in a boat, like a canoe or a kayak or something, and you see the shark, and then it's gone, you're going to spend the next hour wondering where it is. And it's probably 30 kilometers away from you. Basque said in the last 10 years he has seen about 6 sharks, both blue and white. In an article published by a Canadian Journal of Native Studies in 2004 called Ancient Mi'kmaq Customs, A Shaman's Revelations, Earl Lockerbie wrote about a letter from a priest in the 1700s recording a conversation with a shaman who described life before colonization and recounted how they would face attacks from the bad fish. That's what they called the shark, the bad fish.
Yes, because it eats people.
All too often these malicious beings attack the sterns of our canoe so suddenly and without warning that they sink the boat and all who are in it, the letter quotes the shaman as saying. Some escape by swimming, but there are always some who fall prey to these voracious flesh-eating fish. And this is from the back in the 1700s.
Yeah.
Shaman added that the people in the canoes would try to harpoon the creature and fend it off for a short time, giving them a chance to paddle towards land. Melissa and Todd Labrador, canoe builders from Kaspukwik, in South Nova Scotia, said there is traditional knowledge for fending off sharks. And this is what brought this to our attention.
Yes, this is the one I saw. I think I saw it on Instagram or something.
Mm-hmm. They said their ancestors hunted whales and porpoises from long birch bark canoes with a rise in the middle built for navigating ocean waters. They say her ancestors would try to trick sharks into thinking the animals were getting too close to land. If you come too close to shore, you risk the chance of beaching yourself, she says. It's what my people knew through generations of observations. So they would take roots and tie it to the bottom of the canoe with eelgrass or different things that would be close to the shore. By splitting spruce roots and strapping them to the canoe with other plants, they would secrete an oil into the water that sharks can taste. Then if the shark saw the bottom of the canoe, instead of thinking, oh, that looks like a lovely seal for lunch, he would feel nervous because he might be too close to the shoreline.
That's really neat. They used its own instincts, of its own survival instincts, to make it think it's too close to land, so it won't go near you because it thinks it's getting too close to land.
So how come we don't do that now? Especially down in Australia. Why aren't they doing that down there?
Yeah. Well, it's in the video that I watched, it showed them doing this stuff to fend off the sharks. Although it's not a problem in modern times.
No.
It was more risky back in the day. But it's very interesting, eh?
Well, you know, and that's the thing is you see all these ancient techniques and stuff that have been lost to time.
Exactly. Yeah.
That they're like, well, they were doing that like that long ago.
Mm-hmm.
Why didn't that get that? I mean, of course, you know, in the 1700s, you didn't have the internet to spread that kind of thing. But I wonder if somebody, you get that down in like Australia or somewhere where there is prevalent great whites.
Yeah.
Do the same sort of thing with the materials, local materials.
Yep.
I wonder if it would work down there.
See, now the problem is too that I think it depends on location. So, you know, in Australia and stuff, when you see sharks, they come really close to shore. And I've seen videos of, I saw a video of a shark almost coming up on the beach to grab somebody's dog. The shark was jumping out and then wiggling back into the water. So I don't think...
I've seen that with killer whales as well.
Yes, yes, for mm-hmm. seals and stuff.
Yeah.
So I think on a sandy beach type area, the risk is less. But whereas on the Atlantic coast, it's a lot of rocks and exposed rocks, and the waves will just crash the shark against, you know, dash him against the rocks. So I think it's different. I think it depends on topography as well.
Mm-hmm.
That's my educated guess, because I don't know that for a fact.
You're wrong.
probably.
No, I'd be interested. There's got to be something to deter them.
Yeah.
That you could sort of use the same sort of techniques,
exactly.
but something else.
It's interesting, though, eh?
Yeah. Like I say, they got written evidence from the 1700s
mm-hmm.
on this is how we used to do it.
Yeah.
And now that the, like I say, if I knew if I was going to a place that there's been a lot of sightings,
yeah,
I'd try something like that. Just put a whole, I mean, it's going to suck for drag.
Yeah.
You know, like when you're trying to make some distance. And we would have made it here earlier, but, you know, we're dragging a log under the boat. but as well, if you got stuff dangling under the boats, if you know fishing, I bet you there's going to be fish hanging out under there too.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So...
you're going to draw in the fish.
Right? Drop a net down one side, pull it up the other side.
Exactly, yeah.
And get everybody that's under your boat.
Yeah, keel haul the fish.
Oh, that'd be awesome. Yeah. Good ideas from the 1700s.
I know, right?
But, yeah, that's... I don't know, man. They're coming back. Everything's getting warmer, so they're getting closer and closer. And porpoises. Well, we talked about the dolphins and that in coming up through New York. But porpoises, to me, have always been a warm water. I never really thought of porpoises coming up to Canada.
True.
Whales, yeah. I mean, whale. Now sharks are coming and porpoises are here.
What is it? It's not... Is it steelhead salmon? Like, some of these fish are... They spend half their life in the ocean...
Yeah, and then the salmon and that, they come right back up.
And they spawn in the fresh waters, so they mm-hmm. can transition between the two.
Yep.
So that's interesting in itself, right? Fresh mm-hmm. water, salt water. Hmm.
Weird. All mm-hmm. these fish. So we are getting closer and closer to fall.
Oh, yes we are. Or are we?
Today, man. I open up the back door today, and it's like a blast furnace.
I know, it's
like,
hot out.
It's the end of August. Like, September's like
what's
next
going
week.
On? I thought I was putting my air conditioner away for the season.
Yeah, apparently not. Fall get closer up here, but we have to remember it's the opposite south of the equator.
Exactly.
So there is a message posted by the National Sea Rescue Institute of South Africa. And this is why I saw this. I'm like, oh... Yeah, we always talk about getting ready for summer here.
Yeah, and you forget about
And people in the southern hemisphere are listening going, what are you talking about? We're putting our boats away. Like they are for sure, right? Yeah, whatever.
Yeah, but as we slide into winter, they're sliding into spring.
Right?
And summer.
So the National Sea Rescue Institute of South Africa has put out this page saying with... spring just around the corner, paddlers eagerly anticipate the return to the water. However, as the paddling season begins, it's essential to prioritize safety to ensure a fun and incident-free experience. National Sea Rescue Institute, the NSRI, strongly advises paddlers to be well prepared and equipped before embarking on any water adventure. And here are some vital safety tips to keep in mind. And they got five tips they talk about on here. So anybody that's in the southern hemisphere, sliding into summer,
yep,
spring, yep. This is for you.
Yeah, reach out to us. Let us know if you're sliding into spring and summer. I'm interested to see who in the Southern Hemisphere is listening to us.
I thought you were going to say, I'm interested in knowing who's going into summer. They all are, moron.
But it'd be neat to hear from somebody that is on the opposite side of the planet from us, right?
Yeah, they're happy summer's beginning and just we're sort of happy summer's ending because kids are going back to school. Number one, assess the conditions before you paddle. Before venturing out, it's crucial to thoroughly assess the weather and water conditions. Pay attention to wind strength, direction, and size of swells and waves. Remember, the conditions can change rapidly, so it's vital to stay alert even if the forecast is favorable. Additionally, ensure that your craft is in top condition. Check the rudder, seating, and other essential components to avoid any malfunctions on the water. It's what we do here. Number two, wear appropriate safety gear. Your personal flotation device is an indispensable part of your safety gear. It's non-negotiable. Wear a certified high visibility PFD at all times. Whistle attached to your PFD is a small but essential tool that can help attract attention in an emergency. Moreover, the use of leashes for both your paddle and craft is crucial, but remember not to cross the surf line with your leash attached, as this could lead to injury or equipment damage. I wonder how many... You gotta think it's law that you have to have a PFD, like, everywhere. I wonder if there's any countries that don't make it a law.
I'm sure there's lots.
Like, I mean, it's not a law that you have to wear it, as we know.
Yeah.
Because that's a massive debate. But I don't know that I've ever heard of a country or anybody saying, no, you don't have to have one.
Yeah, we don't care about you.
Yeah, we don't care. Whatever. But I wonder how, I mean, because we have we've got to have the PFD, we've got to have a whistle, we've got to have a light device, we've got to have a rope, we've got to have a bail bucket.
Yep.
Right? It makes you wonder how many different countries follow the exact same rules and how many just say, wear a life jacket, don't be a dummy.
Some of these lawless countries, mm-hmm. I'm sure, would, it doesn't matter.
But that's what the paddle leash. I mean, I would never put a leash on my paddle. But I wonder if they're talking,
If you're kayaking, though, say you get blown down and you get rolled in the ocean in some surf, and if your paddle is not attached to you, then you get separated from it. It's kind of, well, you should have a spare, but still. And so it is interesting to think. So when you do have, and they're saying here about the leashes and having it on the paddle, having it on watercraft, careful of the brake line so that... the surf line where you have to break through and you don't want to be attached because it could be dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
It reminds me, I've seen videos popping up recently of whitewater stand-up paddleboarders.
Oh, they're huge now all of a sudden, eh?
And these guys
going over waterfalls. And
yeah. And it's amazing how good they are taking the stand-up paddleboards down whitewater, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, wow. You know, they're like... running and bouncing off of rocks and doing turns and
yeah, like, if you're doing stuff like that,
and they had leashes,
you got to have the leashes.
They
on.
Had leashes on,
but do you think they did? You happen to notice was there a leash connecting them to their paddle?
I didn't notice that. I wasn't looking. I was making note of the leash on from their ankle to the stand up paddle.
Yeah,
board.
That I've seen,
and I've heard too that there's. They're coming out with leashes now for stand-up paddleboards. They're breakaway leashes. Like they don't separate easily. But if you're in a pinch, it'll break free, which prevents you from if your paddleboard goes around a rock one way and you go around the rock the other way, or on either sides of a log or something, it's a trapping. Well, we recently talked about the woman who's a chef, and she. Somehow got caught underneath a barge or something, or I can't remember what it was, but she had drowned. She was out with friends and she got rolled underneath something and she couldn't break free because she was strapped to her paddleboard. We talked about it briefly a couple weeks back.
Did we talk about it?
Yeah.
There's been so many.
I know.
Every time I do research, somebody else is missing, somebody else is dead. It's gotten beyond ridiculous.
Yeah.
Anyway, next one is equip yourself with essential safety tools. Carrying the right safety equipment can make all the difference in an emergency. Always have a VHF radio, a personal locator beacon with you for communication, especially if you're paddling in isolated areas. Store essential items such as pencil flares, emergency steering kit, and a fully charged mobile phone with a safe TRX app installed in a waterproof pouch attached to your PFD. Test all your gear before heading out to ensure everything is functioning correctly. And I mean, that's like a ditch kit too, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And Safe TRX app, that must be something that's local to South Africa and stuff.
Yeah, but I mean, everything is like, make sure there's your communication stuff is on your person.
Exactly.
Not in your, a bag attached to your yoke or something like that.
Exactly.
Because
you get separated.
It doesn't do you any good. We found his phone, unfortunately.
He wasn't with it.
Practice remounting and self-rescue techniques. And this one hit me because I don't remember the last time I was in my canoe, and I know I can do it, but I've not actually practiced it in years, getting back into the canoe.
Yeah, it's been years since I've done that as well.
Like, yeah. One of the most common challenges paddlers face is remounting their craft after capsizing. It's vital to regularly practice remounting in various conditions, ensuring you're comfortable doing so even in rough water. Additionally, familiarize yourself with self-rescue techniques, as these skills are crucial if you find yourself separated from your craft or in the event of an equipment failure. Yeah, I should do... I'd say I should do that this summer, but this is, we're going into fall. I'm not practicing it now. But yeah, that's just one of those things, because there's all these little things. Oh, yeah, I can do that. I can do it. But when was the last time you actually practiced it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think next summer I'll practice more.
Mm-hmm.
We should get together and...
I used to do that early on. I used to get out into a shallow part of the lake and dump the canoe over and then try and you know, I was learning the technique of righting the canoe and getting as much water out at the same time, where you do a little flip roll of the canoe and then you leap out of the water as much as you can and grab the opposite gunwale and pull yourself in without flipping the canoe while you're trying to get in. There's all kinds of, or come over the stern to the bow or stuff like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or, and I remember doing, we used to do the, when I was in the kayak club out in Victoria, BC, we would always have these winter sessions, pool sessions in the base gym. And we would practice roll techniques and rescue techniques, and so you self-rescue, team rescue, and how to get into a kayak in the water. And so it was, we did all that stuff, right? We'd all get together as a group and you know, we train each other type thing. We didn't have an instructor, we just did it ourselves, right? So yeah, so it's a good thing to practice coming into the season, just like they suggest here.
Never paddle alone and inform others of your plan. And that's, I mean, anytime you're going paddling, really. Paddling with a buddy is a fundamental safety practice, as having someone nearby can be life-saving in an emergency. Always inform someone on land about your route and expected return time. If you encounter trouble, don't hesitate to call for help. Delaying your call can make rescue efforts more challenging and dangerous. And that's one of the things I've gotten to the habit of, is I'll leave my spot unit, you know, link so people can follow where I am. And if they notice, well, wait a minute, he hasn't moved in 2 days and he's supposed to be 60 miles away from where he is.
Exactly.
Something's not right. And I also give them here's where we're going. Here's our route. Here's where we're going to be on this day sort of thing, so that people know. Oh yeah. I mean, barring any trouble with, you know, bad weather or
your canoe or
thunder, lightning, that sort of thing, we're going to be pretty much on schedule, right? But yeah, always leave your information with people that so something goes wrong, they can, if authorities come looking, you've got some information to give them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
As you gear up for paddling season, remember that safety is paramount. By taking necessary precautions, such as assessing conditions, wearing the appropriate gear, carrying essential safety tools, and practicing vital skills, you can ensure a safe and enjoyable experience on the water. The NSRI urges all paddlers to stay vigilant and well-prepared, making this spring paddling season both safe and memorable. So everybody in the Southern Hemisphere are gearing up for their spring and summer paddling. Enjoy. Hope you guys all have a fantastic paddling season. There's an MP, an NDP MP politician guy, Taylor Bachrach, out in BC, northwestern BC. He canoes solo through his remote riding every summer. So you know how most people, they'll go around to the town hall and people come and, hey, everybody, my constituents, my
old babies,
constituents, that's the word. Yeah. Shaking babies and holding hands or some kissing hands or whatever it is. So he's got a remote riding.
Yes.
And every summer he paddles it. Paddling solo for 174 kilometers down the Kispiox and Skeena rivers in northwestern British Columbia every summer, NDP MP Taylor Bachrach encounters rapids, storms, grizzly bears, and a spectacular landscape in his unusual effort to connect with his constituents. I'm not going to let that word mess me up. It's nothing like the summer barbecue circuit that occupies many of his parliamentary colleagues once the House of Commons rises. He says that for him, it's a chance to celebrate the wilderness with the people who sent him to Ottawa. I think we have a lot of opportunities for meetings under fluorescent lights in boardrooms, and that's important. But when you sit on the bank of a river and you talk about this place we call home, there's something extra special about it, he says. With a population of just under 90,000, a third of it indigenous, spread across more than 325,000 square kilometers, it's one of Canada's most thinly populated federal electoral districts. It's also home to one of Canada's most beautiful and isolated landscapes, where communities still see the rivers as the lifeblood of their communities. You never really think about the elections. We are all focused down southern Canada way. Right?
Exactly, we're in the 90%.
Yeah, you don't think about up there where there's a big area. Somebody's got to be elected to look after that. So. He says, each year I drive up and down the highway probably 50 or so times, and I'm always looking at the river and thinking about years gone by. A couple years ago, I had the idea that I could visit those communities the old way by river, and that it would be a neat way to connect with folks. He's always looking to bring a little bit of himself to his role as an MP, and since canoeing has always been a passion, a tradition was born. His first journey in 2022, the summer of 2024, was his third. Each year he puts in at the Kispiox River, tributary of the Skeena, about 25 kilometers north of Hazelton, and pulls out 5 days later in Terrace. Bachrach does the trip unassisted, carries everything he needs in his canoe, camps along the river's edge, and visits the villages along his path that now expect his arrival every summer. So that's pretty cool. I mean, rather than doing it by car.
It's an interesting way. And I think the people in his constituents would really appreciate it more that he's going and he's taking his time to paddle the river and drop into the communities along the rivers. And so it's more of a personal way to meet and greet.
Well, especially when it's people that know the land and
know
and
the land,
river.
And they spend their lives on the land.
And yeah, and it's an important part of their lives, right?
Yeah, he's not some guy in a nice car driving up and down and meeting them, right?
It's I'm not showing up in my fully loaded Yukon.
Yeah.
Cadillac, whatever. There are folks who spend time, a lot of time on the river who know that I do this trip and I bump into some of the people every year that I've done it. But of course, there's always surprises. Backrack's first night camping this summer was marred by heavy rain. He said he put out a call to let people in Kispiok's village know that he was coming and was warned a big grizzly bear had been spotted eating salmon near his planned campsite.
Well, that could be a problem.
It could be an issue. Folks from the village were coming down throughout the night to check on me, which I really appreciated. Luckily, the bear didn't show up and I didn't have any issues, he says. He wasn't so lucky last year. I was camped right near the confluence of the Kitsugakla River and the Skeena, and it's a spot where there's a lot of bears that are pretty active eating fish. In the middle of the night, something woke me up, and I put my headlamp on and opened the door of my tent, and there was a young grizzly bear snooping around. If that's where they're all sitting there eating their fish, why would you camp anywhere near there?
Well, he's stopping on the river. He's not going to trudge into the bush and
But
camp.
If you know that it's... No. But if you know that the confluence is where they're all hanging out.
Yeah, yeah.
Either stop way before it or go way past it.
Mm-hmm. But I don't think you can get away from areas where there's going to be bears. They're going to be everywhere.
Yeah, but you know they're going to be centered around one area. Stay away from that area. Go through it really fast. Maybe slap a bear on the ass as you're going by, but just keep on rolling, bub.
He is a politician, right? They're not that smart.
You know. Backrack said he kept the bear spray holstered, managed to scare the bear off with some stern words. Listen here, young man. Spent the rest of the night watching out for its return. It's the bear's home, and I'm visiting, so I try to be respectful, keep a respectful outlook on the situation. Connecting with indigenous peoples and their history, Backrack said, is always a highlight of his summer trips down the Skeena. This year, he stopped near Kitsilis Canyon to hike up to see the petroglyphs, rock carvings left by indigenous people in the area thousands of years ago. It was a really powerful spot reflecting the long history of the Tsimshian people. On his way down the cliffs, he said he met members of Kitsilis First Nation fishing on the river, spoke to them about issues important to them, particularly the state of the salmon stocks. And that's the perfect reason for doing this. He's getting to the people that, you know, are using the river.
Exactly.
And you can have a one-on-one personal, non-rushed, official, I guess, like everybody's coming to town hall. Everybody take a seat.
Exactly.
Raise your hand if you want to speak and go grab the microphone and that sort. You can have a calm, relaxed conversation about what's important.
Yeah, and it's nice to be able to do it one-on-one and
while fishing for salmon.
Mm-hmm.
There are people who depend on salmon, and there are a lot of issues around the conservation and rebuilding of the wild salmon stock in the Skeena. But not just the Skeena, right across British Columbia, he says. So that always comes up. Bagrak said he also got to see a father from First Nation community take his son out for his first fishing trip and was given some salmon to keep that fed him along the journey. Brings me a lot of joy and something different in terms of the rest of the role, which involves a lot of flying back and forth across Canada and sitting in the House of Commons. It's a tradition that I think I'm going to keep up over the years as long as I can, and each year do it a little bit differently and try to connect in some different way. That's cool.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, somebody going out of their way. You elect the guy to go up there, sit in there and represent you, and he's taking the time to, you know, slowly make his way and see how many people he can visit and chat with and get their concerns so that when everything packs back up and he heads back to Ottawa, he can bring those concerns and
exactly.
work on them.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. What are we drinking tonight anyway?
Oh, yes. So once again, Tilted Glass. It's local, so it's easier for me to pick up. So it's got a picture of the Bowmanville Fish Ladder on it. This is a Tilted Glass, is a Bowmanville brewery, and it's called Upstream IPA.
Because the salmon are swimming upstream.
Mm-hmm. But it's what's neat is it's got a picture of our of the Bowmanville fish letter.
Oh, and it actually says in big black letters on the side of the can, local series.
Mm-hmm. Very cool.
Not too bad.
Yeah, it's sold, so that's why it used to be Man Antler.
Mm-hmm.
One of the employees bought out the previous owner, and so the, and they've done some really neat things with the beers lately. It's very interesting. This is a IPA.
Yeah, I'm not a huge IPA fan, but this one's not bad.
Mm-hmm. Very good.
I have to dig my dry suit out soon.
Oh, yes.
I got to get some wax for the zipper.
Wax or silicone? What do they recommend?
I don't know. It's a little waxy thing that you rub up and down. Oh,
okay,
on
so yeah. Because my dry suit for scuba diving, I use a silicone grease.
Yeah. So this is just so that it opens and...
Hmm.
Yeah, because it's not the easiest to unzip, especially if you're by yourself.
Yeah.
I've been out a couple of times, and I'm just like, can you help me get undressed? Sorry, dude.
Yeah.
Yeah, sometimes I got to get that. But, yeah, get used to it. I like being able to paddle in the colder months. But man, it's a pain in the ass putting that thing on and off.
Yeah.
And I got to get a new set of shoes or boots. Because the ones I have, it's too hard to put them on with. Because it's got the booties built into the. Because I got the Kokatat.
But you will wear a different pair of boots over top to protect it from
getting
damaged.
Holes and stuff like that. But that pair of shoes that have fit over top, they fit once. They fit. But, oh my God, it is so hard to get them on over top of everything. And if you put a different pair of heavy... I don't know what heavy socks I was wearing when I went and tested it out, because everything fit great.
Yeah.
I don't know what pair of heavy socks I was wearing, because now the heavy socks I'm wearing is not great. It's a pain in the arse. So, but there's other ones that are, you know, just slide on, and they're open, and then you put your... And then zips up as opposed to... Like a regular shoe sort of deal.
Yep,
so I think I got to look into something different for this year. But the big thing about dry suits, everybody complains, the price.
Yes. Well, it's a double-edged sword. You want something of quality.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but, you know, if you're, like, there's some I've seen on the market that are like, you know, $1,800 or $1,500.
$2,000.
Yeah.
And some days when you get $2,000 in your pocket unexpectedly, you go out and you buy it.
Yeah.
And it damn well better keep you dry for the
next
100 years, because
the suit better last 10 years.
Yeah. Well, I know I've gotten a couple good years out of it so far, right? But the one big thing everybody says is, it's the price. And I do have an issue spending $2,000 on a dry suit. $1,500 and up on a dry suit is very hard pill to swallow.
It is, yes.
Like I say, I did not have a dry suit for many, many years. I just ended up with money in my pocket at the right time, the right place, and I said, I'm just going to do it. I didn't think twice, just did it.
Yeah.
Now I think about it thinking I could use that money for so many other things. However.
It really depends on how heavily you're going to use the dry suit.
Yeah.
If you are a trip, like a whitewater instructor or something like that, and you're going to be on the river every day, and you're going to get a lot of use out of it, then it kind of makes sense, because it's how many times you use it, how many times you wear it. And so the more you wear it, the dollar per use goes down, right?
Yeah.
But if you're going to use it once... That one time cost you
$2,000 to go out for the day. Yeah. $1,000? It doesn't seem like a big drop from $1,500 to $1,000.
It makes a difference.
But I would have less a big time less problem dropping $1,000 than $1,500. So Mustang Survival, they're out in BC.
Yes.
They've just launched the all-new Quadra Dry Suit. Mustang Survival, a Canadian brand known for innovative solutions for the most demanding marine environments, has announced the launch of the Quadra Dry Suit. This brand new minimalist multi-purpose dry suit is designed for those who enjoy shorter duration water activities and is available in men's and women's versions. So this is for people going out for, we're going paddling for a few hours.
Yeah.
Or the day or whatever. They're not going on a 6-month excursion.
Well, it's not just that too. It's like with Mustang, a lot of their survival gear is designed for like open ocean fishermen and search and rescue people and so on. They have some really serious heavy duty gear, right? So mm-hmm. like if you're open ocean in the Atlantic, you're fishing off of Newfoundland or whatever, everybody has to have their own dry suit on board, because if you get dumped in the ocean, you're going to die if you don't have a dry suit, right?
Yep.
And so a lot of these dry suits are designed for emergency procedures and emergency use, whereas this new Quadra dry suit, it's designed for people who are recreational users, like kayakers and whitewater canoers and so on. So it's designed with the purpose of shorter duration, as in like recreational users.
Mm-hmm. Minimalist and multi-purpose. It's sure to ring bells without the whistles.
Yes.
Quadra Dry Suit features the same tough and durable 3-layer marine spec BP fabric used in their other dry suits, with a design inspired by the gear they've innovated for military and public safety agencies and subjected to the same comprehensive testing.
Okay, you go.
So, that's what I know said. It's going to work. That's what Derek said. Key features of the Quadra Dry Suit: durable fabric, waterproof and abrasion resistant 3-layer marine spec BP fabric, holds up in challenging saltwater environments. Custom fit, trimmable latex neck and wrist seals for maximum protection and comfort. Easy maintenance, collar and cuffs design make repair and replacement straightforward. Adjustable waist belt ensures a snug fit accommodating various body types. Are you saying I'm fat? Heavy-duty reinforcements. 500D Cordura panels in the seat and knees add durability. Which is perfect, because, I mean, with the kayak, you're sitting.
Yep.
And with canoes, a lot of times you're kneeling.
Oh, exactly, yeah. So you need some flexibility.
So you need that durability, yeah. Convenient drying. External hanging loop simplifies the drying process. See, with mine, I put a hanger up through the neck.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And then I hang it, so it looks like there's a body hanging. When you walk down our stairs, and if I leave the laundry room door open, light from the comes in through the window and illuminates it, so it looks like there's a body hanging. User-friendly zipper, waterproof YKK AquaSeal zipper for easy donning and doffing. Now, the one thing I looked, there's no cover over the zipper.
Okay, yeah.
Like my Kokatat, you zip it up, and then there's with some Velcro there, there's a cover that covers the zipper.
Mm-hmm.
This doesn't look like there is one.
Yeah,
just zipper. Leak-proof assurance. Every suit undergoes comprehensive leak testing, ensuring superior performance and reliability. Dry suits often come with a hefty price tag, and understandably so, as a lot of engineering and materials go into a specialized garment that keeps you completely dry, says Anya Mueller, head of marketing at Mustang Survival. With the Quadra, we offer people new to cold water marine activities the same quality materials at a budget-friendlier price.
Nice.
So there's a men and women's version. They come in different colors. Ocean blue, Admiral Gray, and red and Admiral Gray. sizes small to XL. Sorry, small to double XL for men and extra small to extra large for women.
Hmm.
Retail price, $850 US or $1,000 Canadian.
That's a good price.
That is a decent price. I would have no problems dropping a grand on a dry suit.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah. Especially, you know, if it's a good quality, heavy duty one that's going to do me
mm-hmm.
for a number of years. And a grand, yeah, I wouldn't balk at spending a grand on it.
Especially, I think a key thing, and we'll have to wait to see some reviews come out of it, but for, in a lot of cases, like if you're doing some spring tripping or, like I remember when I did, we had arranged for a custom whitewater course at MKC. And because there's some weekend courses and some all week courses, 5 day courses, 7 day courses, we arranged for a specialized. We said we want a 3 day course because normally it's 2 day for the weekend, right? And
right.
We got the long weekend. We went up and we arranged to have a custom course put on. And the instructor, he was always in his dry suit.
Yeah,
always in his dry suit when we were on the river, and so it was. For uses like that, it needs to be comfortable. It needs to be comfortable, yeah. and you need to be able to shuck out of it easily if you need to go to the bathroom or whatever, right? So if it's easy to use, easy to don and doff, easy to, comfortable to sit in it all day or walk around in it all day, I think that's important. So I'm looking forward to seeing some proper reviews of this Mustang survival mm-hmm. suit, the dry suit.
My big thing is the zipper has to be easy enough to open that mm-hmm. you can get out of it quickly.
So I don't remember looking at the pictures. Was the zipper on the front or the back?
Front.
It was on the front.
Same straight across.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, once you get that zipper open, you're boop, 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 right out.
Yeah.
Right?
Hmm.
Yeah, I'll have to take a peek.
Yeah.
Looking forward to see people
using it.
Some reviews on it, but yeah, 1,000 compared to 2,000 or 1,500.
Yeah, it's a big difference.
It is
for the price point. It makes a big difference.
Well, I mean, if you drop 1,000 on that, and then you're dropping another, you know, 100 or 200 on a pair of good shoes,
yeah,
as well,
yeah.
Right? And I mean, then you got taxes and everything. Adds up fast, like really fast. So. Other people that are wearing dry suits right now, or were, Canadian kayaker Simon Carrier and Maxime Geoffroy have ended their attempt to paddle the Northwest Passage from west to east. So they were starting, they did the opposite direction of the Arctic Cowboys from last year, which we always thought was a pretty good
strategy
was doing from east to west.
And when we talked to West about it, he explained the whole theory on going from the east to the west because the winter, towards the end, you're going south. You're mm-hmm. heading south, so winter is chasing you down.
Yeah.
Whereas if you go from west to east, you have to go north towards the end. And so if you're getting close to winter, you're heading into the cold, into the ice, into the snow.
Winter and you are heading to a confrontation.
Exactly, yeah.
They were on the west side of King William Island and are backtracking to finish at Joe Haven, the island's one community. They decided to end their 3,000-kilometer expedition after little more than halfway. Thick sea ice blocked their progress around the northern tip of King William Island. More ice is waiting in the Peel Sound. So, yeah, they found winter.
Yes. And I think what it is, so the Arctic Cowboys, they timed it right last year when they had a very low ice year. I think the ice is, I think it was a harsher winter and a milder summer. So it's not, the ice didn't fully clear out.
Mm-hmm.
What was interesting too is, when in this story, in the article, when they talked about them canceling their expedition, they supplied, there was a supplied ice chart, and it's like a weather prediction chart. Well, this was an ice prediction chart. And so it was interesting to show, so the stuff on the map in green was like very light ice cover, easy travel. Yellow, you might have some difficulty. Then the red one was either piled up ice or sheet ice. And so it was interesting to see the ice coverage. And there's some areas that didn't have coverage. But when you have yachts and fishermen and communities and so on using out there, using the water for, it's part of the lifestyle up there, then it makes sense that the federal government is going to provide a map and show ice cover and show where there's going to be restrictions to travel. And on this map, it showed a big red band that would be blocking their path to get up to Belleau Strait.
Mm-hmm.
Belleau Strait. And so they there's even word that there's a few ships that were waiting in near Belleau Strait for the ice to clear, because they were also had difficulty navigating because of the large ice flows and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it was interesting to see the map. It makes sense that it exists, but it kind of surprised me. It's like, oh yeah, that makes sense. Why you should be, federal government should be producing a ice prediction map,
right?
So, and it helped them make their decision.
Because, well, especially with more people trying to go through these days.
Yeah. There's a lot of ship traffic, shipping traffic, and commercial traffic, and there's cruise ships that are heading up there now, and so some of these smaller, more compact winter ice breaking cruise ships that, you know, take tourism dollars into the area. And so it makes sense that you're going to want a ice map.
Mm-hmm. Since beginning their journey in mid-July, the pair has typically averaged over 40 kilometers per day.
That's pretty good.
Yep. But even if the ice cleared, the delay would have forced them to paddle deeper into the stormy fall. Because that's the other thing. Got the storms and everything coming, too.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah. That brings the wind. That brings the high waves.
And they're heading into wide open water.
Yep. Their final 1,000 kilometers would include several big open water crossings, including 80 kilometers from Somerset Island to Baffin Island. And at this time of year, night has returned. They would not be able to enjoy the advantage of constant daylight on these marathon crossings. Climate change has made the Northwest Passage easier than it was in John Franklin's day, but some summers, ice can still throw a wrench into every mariner's plans. Kayakers could have chosen to go around the south coast of King William Island, the standard route through the Northwest Passage, but if ice conditions are good, the northern route saves many kilometers. Last year, the Arctic Cowboys took advantage of the good ice year and to transit the entire passage from east to west, including an ice-free route around northern King William Island. Even if they had taken the southern route, the passage through Belleau Strait remains ice-choked for the moment. Several small yachts are anchored in eastern Belleau Strait, waiting for the ice to clear before they can continue west. Unfortunately, Mother Nature is either with you or against you.
And it's just one of those things. It's like, when is it time to throw in the towel? When do you cut your losses? And so it's to get one of these expeditions off the ground and into reality, it's a lot of time and effort, a lot of people's time, not just the people who went, but there's other supporters. And so it's a lot of time and effort, money, you know, they had to plan for the route. They had to get all the permits that they needed and so on. And it's one of those things. It's like, it's going to be too difficult to finish it based on the ice conditions. And
yeah. So if you push it,
you could be risking
life. Well, and you risk, okay, when you finally push it and say, we can't do it anymore, and you turn around to come back, it may be too late. You may be facing
rescue.
You may be having to get a rescue because the ice is surrounding you, cutting you off the other way. And now you're surrounded on all sides. Or like you say, with the storms coming in,
yeah,
you know, that could be an issue as well.
Yeah. And so if you have to, if you push it that way and you force it where you're either a self-rescue or a rescue, and then you're involving other people who put their lives at risk to get you out and so mm-hmm. on. It's like they're making the right choice. If it was becoming that ice choke that even other smaller yachts and so on were having to anchor and wait for ice to clear, then, you know, how safe is it going to be for a kayaker, right?
Yeah.
Now, so there's another group also doing it. They're going.
They're rowing. But they're going east to west.
East to west.
Yeah.
And so they should be in the vicinity of the Bellot Strait right now, I believe, because that's where they were expecting to meet up with this group. They were thinking they're going to cross paths in the Bellot Strait.
I thought they were further along than that.
Well, I don't know.
Yeah. I've just been following the kayakers, not
exactly.
The rowers.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I thought it was a man and woman, apparently.
No.
Maxime is a man's name.
Yeah, you're thinking Maxine.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah. Mother Nature's out to get everybody.
Oh, yes. When you sent this to me, I was like, what?
I got an email back.
Are you kidding me?
A rare deadly equine virus that can be transmitted to humans, killing about 30% of people afflicted, has been spotted in several Hudson Valley counties and surrounding states. Elderly Massachusetts man was recently infected, and the virus has killed a horse in Orange County, according to health officials. The Eastern Equine Encephalitis Virus, EEE, is spread from horses to people through mosquitoes. It's bad enough that the ticks are trying to kill us.
I know.
Mother Nature said, ticks, I know you're trying to get
everybody.
Take
a back seat this year.
I got an ally for you. Mosquitoes, here we go.
Yeah.
Send in the mosquitoes. Those who survive commonly develop ongoing neurological issues, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Coma and seizures are also possible. There are no vaccines to prevent or medicines to treat Eastern Equine Encephalitis, the agency warns. In New England, a Worcester... How do you even say that?
I don't know.
Worcester man? It's almost like Worcestershire.
It looks
sauce.
Like you spelled it wrong.
I did not spell that wrong. A Worcester man in his 80s was infected by EEE earlier this month, the first case in more than 4 years for Massachusetts. It is a rare but serious disease in a public health concern, says Massachusetts Public Health Commissioner Robbie Goldstein. Locally, along with Orange, EEE has been found in Ulster, St. Lawrence, Madison, Oneida, Cayuga, Wayne, and Washington counties, the New York State Department of Health reports. That's starting to spread up the old East Coast there.
It's coming.
City of Newburgh on the Hudson River was where an unvaccinated horse succumbed to the disease, as did another in Atlantic County, New Jersey. Horse in Clinton County next to the Canadian border in New York also tested positive. Positive test in a horse lets us know that EEE is circulating in mosquitoes that bite mammals, including humans. We continue to monitor and assess mosquito and virus activity, said Orange County Department of Health Commissioner Dr. Alicia Pointer. A wild turkey in Maine was also recently diagnosed, and a deer in Connecticut died from it in August.
So it gets carried through everything.
Like every animal, every
turkeys
mammal
and horses and deer and...
Oh, my. So far, no one in New York has been impacted, according to the state agency, but sudden headaches, high fevers, chills, and vomiting are all warning signs and typically appear between 4 to 10 days after mosquito bite. Those over age 50 and under 15 are the highest risk.
That's us.
Oh, Derek, you're going to get it.
So I'm... My age is over 50, but my mental age is under 15.
So you're doubly going to get it. Mosquitoes will be present in our communities until at least the end of September, so it's important to be mindful of how we can protect ourselves when spending time outdoors. Wearing long sleeves, using bug spray containing DEET, and checking window screens for holes are all preventative measures. But I mean, it's coming to a point where you just can't go outside then.
Oh, I know, right? It's like everything's trying to kill you.
Yeah. You know what? Like, I mean, with the ticks, people have been going on and on and on and on and on about so many ticks, so many ticks, so many ticks.
Milder winters.
I haven't had one on me yet.
Near have I.
I mean, I haven't been outside as much this year, mm-hmm. but in previous years, like, I was spending all this time out in the trails and in the backcountry and everything, and nothing.
Yeah.
You know, walking through long grass and nothing. My dog's not had anything. I've not had anything.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah, fingers crossed. So, mosquitoes don't bite me as much as they used to.
But they're everywhere.
The bug jacket people are going to make a kill.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
They're going to rake in the bucks next year. Because if this is going to become the next big thing,
yep.
Get a bug suit. I'm just going to wear my dry suit all year round and a and a bug head net.
Yeah.
Oh, I'll be one sexy beast out on the trails. I saw this guy. He had gloves. He had a dry suit and a bug head net. Portaging down the trail. Goofiest thing you've ever seen. But, like I say, there's another serious thing coming down from mosquitoes.
Yeah.
And right now it's the east coast of the U.S. Man, it's not one thing, it's another.
It's crazy. Yeah.
It is crazy.
Yeah, I wasn't happy when you shared that with me today.
No, because I know how much you love going out where all the mosquitoes.
Oh, I love
spring
mosquitoes.
Trips are right off now. Derek's going to he's going to Florida or Cuba or something. Antarctica.
Yeah, stay away from horse farms.
Speaking of Antarctica.
Yeah?
I don't know if it was real or not, but somebody said one of the researchers down there stabbed another researcher because researcher A stabbed researcher B because researcher B was telling researcher A the endings to all the books he was reading.
Oh!
Spoiler. So he finally had enough of all his books being spoiled. He lost it and stabbed dude.
Stabbed him with a frozen squirrel.
Must have. I saw the article once. I haven't seen it again, so I don't know if it's real or not, but I feel your pain.
Yeah.
Derek, you don't.
There's a few interesting things that came across while I was researching. You know, there's in Antarctica, speaking of Antarctica, so I can't remember what they call it. It's like A35B ice shelf has broken free. And so it broke free in the late 70s, early 80s, but then it grounded. Anyways, it broke free of its grounding, and now it's on the move. This thing is like, they say it's 1,350 feet thick. It's 40 miles wide to 40 miles square. It's a gigantic island of ice. Massive. And so it's just...
Where's it going?
It's... they say it just passed the... One of the northernmost peninsulas on Antarctica. So it's heading out in the open waters. And
so see, that's something you go and build a temporary shelter or something on. Like a temporary little building. Yeah. And then you just live on that iceberg till you can't live on it anymore.
There's... there's a movie where they were doing research on it's Day After Tomorrow, where the ice split and they had to jump across the big gap. And
I never watched that one.
It's a good one. I've seen it about 10 times now. Oh, and there's another guy who part of the old Dew line up on Nunavut. Sadly, unfortunately, he was out doing some whatever work they do on these bases.
Right.
It's a radar station up north.
Yep.
And he got attacked by two polar bears.
That wasn't alert, was it?
No, no. It's much farther south. It's south. Okay. It's north of Labrador. It's I can't remember the name of the island, but it's east of Hudson's Bay, north of Labrador. It's on the tip of one of these. It's way south of where all these people are traveling, Arctic cowboys and stuff.
Yeah.
So it's, I looked it up on a map. It's just this remote radar station, part of the old Dew line.
Hmm.
And they still use it. It's still in use.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
You got anything else?
I don't. I do. That's not. It.
So I'm up in a Tomogony right now enjoying the time.
I'm enjoying my week off of not recording.
Of not recording and rubbing it in that the kids are back at school.
Yeah.
So how was your day at school?
And I hope everybody enjoyed last week's episode where we...
Yes, Peter Frank.
Yeah, interviewed Peter Frank.
He's making his way, so definitely following along and see how he's doing. And all's good.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Exciting. Yeah, good times. If you want to find out more about us, you can find us at paddlingadventuresradio.com. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can download or stream our episodes on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podbean, iHeartRadio, Player FM, and all your favorite podcast downloading sites. Or you can go to the episode page at paddlingadventuresradio.com and you can download or stream all our episodes there. If you enjoy the podcast, please share it with friends, family, and fellow paddlers. I want to thank everybody for listening this week. I'm Sean Rowley.
And I'm Derek Specht. We'll see you next time.